Do you have to think like, or even like, many of those that are seeing their social media accounts wiped to see that social media censorship is a grave concern in a supposedly free society? A recent report from the House of Commons Digital Culture, Media and Sport Committee calls for technology companies to be required to adhere to a code of ethics overseen by an independent regulator. The code would set down in writing what is and is not acceptable on social media, and the regulator would have significant teeth, the power to launch legal action against firms that breach this code. I'm Darren Grimes, and joining me to discuss free speech online is Dr. Steve Davies, the IEA's Head of Education. Hi, Steve.
Hi there, Darren.
Steve, I want to start because it's an interesting position legally, isn't it? Because platforms' business models have until now, I think, been able to develop because their liability, safe harbours, which protects platforms from being liable for content that is posted on them. But that's all changing now, isn't it? I mean, do you think that's a good thing, or do you think we're getting into dangerous territory?
Well, we could potentially be getting into dangerous territory, as I'll perhaps explain in a moment. The thing is that up until now, as you rightly say, social media platforms have essentially been treated as what are called common carriers, which is a legal status that was developed to respond to the appearance of the telephone back in the late 19th and early 20th century. And the decisions made then were that telephone companies could not be responsible for what people said in conversations over their lines. They simply provided the service, and it was the individuals maybe engaging in a conspiracy who were actually held criminally liable, not the firm. And that until recently, until right now, is the position legally of people like Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, all these other platforms. However, as you rightly say, they're coming under enormous pressure, and there are all sorts of moves to submit them to a kind of regulation which would require them to control their content. Now, I have to say that I'm actually opposed to both of the main positions taken in this debate so far. I'm opposed both to the proposals you just outlined and also to the kind of argument which says that somehow if Facebook takes away Tobin Robinson's account or bans Alex Jones, that this is a violation of free speech rights. I think both of those positions are wrong.
And why is that? Is that because it's a private company, it can do what it wants, basically?
Or? Yes, exactly. The point is that Facebook is not, yet anyway, a public utility. It's a private company which is in business to provide a particular product, you can argue about what that is, and make money. And it has no obligation whatever to provide a platform for anybody and everybody. If it finds that providing a platform for certain people is bringing it into disrepute or maybe leading it to lose custom or advertisers, then it's perfectly at liberty to bar those people or block them. It's under no public obligation to provide a platform or space for them. If you think of it in terms of an analogy, if I own a pub and I allow people to have conversations in the pub, I'm perfectly at liberty to bar people if I think that their comments or what they say is provocative or likely to lead to, say, an affray or something. And the situation is really similar in that. So I reject the idea that a private company can be accused of imposing some kind of censorship, given that that's what it is, a purely private firm.
But aren't they, in fact, it's a bit different, isn't it, to a pub, given the scale and usability of them? I mean, isn't it, in fact, a public utility, given their dominance of the emerging online public sphere? And shouldn't they be obliged to give a platform to any speech? You know, who ultimately decides what is acceptable speech?
This is the big problem. The real problem is that we have a market here and an emerging online public space, if you will, in which a lot of discussion and speech takes place, which is dominated by a very small number of firms: Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, YouTube, basically. And so if you are banned from one of those major platforms, your ability to communicate with other people is severely restricted. Now, one solution to that might be to say, as you've just sort of intimated, well, yes, these are actually public utilities. And if indeed they are public utilities, then they should be subject to regulation. Now, the problem with that is this. You might say that, well, the regulation should be that they should be required by law to provide a platform for anybody and everybody apart from people who actually engage in criminal speech like incitement. The problem is, of course, that once you've conceded the initial principle that they are a public entity in some sense, which requires public regulation, There's no saying what you will get. In fact, it's very unlikely, I think, that that kind of robust free speech requirement would be put in place by the regulators. It's far more likely that we would see the kind of regulations you were describing in your introductory remarks, in which all kinds of speech, which happen to be unpopular at the moment with certain people, would be subject to bans and restrictions. And that's extremely dangerous. Actually, the logical conclusion in some ways of this argument is that if they are a public utility, they should be owned by the state. They should be, in fact, be owned by the government in the way that historically the postal service was, for very similar reasons, actually. But if you think about the history, for example, of the US Postal Service, that should really make you wary of doing that, because in the history of the United States, one of the major ways in which restrictions on free speech have been imposed by the federal government there has been through charging people with misusing the mails. It was the major way in which anti-pornography laws, for example, were enforced. And it's also been used very often to catch all kinds of people simply by saying, oh, you've misused the mail, and ridiculously heavy sentences imposed for doing that. And that, I think, is a kind of warning sign of just what risks you can run if you give the political class control over a major infrastructure like this.
And I think, you know, this week, or I can't remember if it was... Actually, it was in February, Facebook banned Tommy Robinson.
Yes.
Now, many people, including myself, I think, would argue that he is one of society's more obnoxious elements. But still, I find it... I'm uncomfortable, I think, with the idea that Facebook can ban someone who is standing for political office. You know, you can argue until you're blue in the face about whether or not his ideas are toxic and all the rest of it. But do you think a platform like Facebook should be able to say to people, you know, voters shouldn't be able to make an informed choice? Is that the realm we're getting into?
That's a very interesting and difficult question. The point is that, take the example of the Post again. Legally, if you are a candidate for a lawful party at an election, you're allowed to send out your propaganda, your election literature through the Post free of charge. It's a major subsidy to the electoral process, in fact. Now, the argument might be that in the modern world, you have to oblige social media platforms to do the same thing. That, however, I think is a specific case to do with providing people who are seeking public office with the means to get their message across in the context of an election. I would actually agree with allowing them to do that, partly on the grounds that I think the more people get to know about people like Tommy Robinson, the less they like them. And so I think that actually the way to deal with unpleasant and objectionable political people is not to try and suppress their ability to put their views across, but rather to actually do that and subject them to robust and forceful criticism and allow them probably to hang themselves in the process, metaphorically, of course. On the other hand, I don't think that that should then extend to affairs in general, because as I said earlier, you're going down a very dangerous road if you argue that a private company should be obliged through some sort of statutory mechanism to provide a platform to anybody and everybody. I don't see how that works. The problem really, as I say, is that we have such a concentrated ownership in this market. If we had, let's say, a dozen social networking sites, or even five or six, and a whole lot of channeling sites, not just one like YouTube, effectively, then the whole issue would become moot, because in a way each platform could then choose which particular kind of demographic it chose to appeal to. Some would have a very wide range of views that they would allow, others might choose to be more selective, and I think that would be much more acceptable and much safer.
How do you balance the risks then? Because you've got, on one hand, your argument so far seemed to be there would be a serious assault on private enterprise if we were to say to Facebook, you cannot ban these people because free speech must be protected. But at the same time, there's a risk of a serious assault and abuse of shutting down speech that people just don't like.
Well, I see. I think that that's only a problem at the moment because we have such concentrated ownership in this sector. Now, the real question here, actually, I think, is an economic one. And it's whether or not this degree of concentration is inevitable. Now, some economists would say it is. The argument would be that what is crucial in a market like social networking or channel sharing is what are called network effects. In other words, the more people who log into your channel, the more valuable it is for everybody who's on it. And what that typically leads to is a marketplace in which, at any one time, there can be only two or three at most major providers, maybe even just one. It's a kind of natural monopoly effect due to the network effects. And basically, if that is the case, then I think the argument for some kind of public regulation does become very strong for the reasons you've given. And in that case, the debate will have to be about what precisely that regulation should be. And in that case, I would go on the side of the free speech demands that you required. However, I'm not sure that actually this is true in this case. I think it's only true because of the business model that the major social media companies have adopted, which basically means that they make their money through data harvesting. And it's that that builds in the really powerful network effects. What I think we need to see is the development of alternative models of funding and alternative business models in social media, depending maybe upon subscriptions or some other fundraising model, which doesn't therefore lead to these pronounced network effects. Now, I think that actually, if we allow things to take their own course, that is what will happen. People will actually build up rivals to the currently dominant companies like Snapchat and Facebook.
You're seeing actually because of the move to ban all of these, what they would term alt-right commentators, that there are these new platforms which are being set up, but there are actually moves to already shut these sites down and therefore keep that monopoly of Facebook in place.
That is the danger. I mean, what I think will happen is that if a company like Facebook, which has got a currently dominant position, does indeed ban or bar a whole lot of people, not just alt-right, but also, for example, radical Islamists, maybe far-left people or extreme environmentalists, there's all sorts of people they're thinking of doing this to, then those people can go off and set up their own platforms. And to the extent that there is a market for these people's views, and unfortunately there is, they will attract sufficient people to make those alternative platforms commercially viable. Now, in that case, the question is, well, should you use the law to ban these platforms? That's a straightforward free speech issue, it seems to me. And in that case, I would be very strongly opposed to the idea that you should stop people privately setting up companies, funding themselves, and putting their views out there. The only grounds on which you should ban anybody in that kind of context are because they're actually openly inciting criminal acts, and that's, you don't need new law for that. That has been the law of the land since the 14th century, so there's no need to bring in new law for that respect.
May I make you Secretary of State for the Department of Digital Culture, Media and Sport?
Yeah.
How do you fix this issue? Because there are increasing demands on these publishers, and it's not just in the United Kingdom, it's global, to ensure that content like that posted after the attacks in Christchurch, the murder in Christchurch. I mean, what would you do in order to, one, protect free speech, but also...
Well, it is a very difficult issue because, for obvious reasons, when you get extreme cases like that, but it's worth bearing in mind the old saying that hard cases make bad law. You don't want to use extreme cases to drive the kind of general default principle that you apply in this case. What I would argue is that if you look at publishing, newspaper, magazine publishing, for example, you have a whole range of publishers, and people can put all kinds of stuff in print, subject to the laws of libel and incitement, of course. And sure, much of this is going to be highly objectionable and disagreeable. There's all kinds of vile stuff out there. But generally speaking, we get along with this. It may be that perhaps we think that somehow something that happens electronically is more public, but actually I don't see that, because just as you have to opt to pick up a magazine or a newspaper, you have to opt to click on a website or follow a thread or go to a channel on YouTube. It's not something that you just stumble across by accident. And so I think that we should apply the same model there that we do in the publishing world. As I said before, the crucial thing I would try to do is to encourage a different business model to develop in this sector, one that doesn't depend so much upon the network effects of data collection for its funding model.
So you wouldn't, one of the founders of Facebook came out this week and said he thinks it needs to be broken up, which is basically what you're saying, but you wouldn't force...
No, I wouldn't do that. No. I mean, yes, I mean, there's one thing to say, this is obviously a bigger issue, the whole question of what you do with monopolies. There's two things to say here. One is that whenever a particular company is in a very dominant position, everyone says, oh, it's never going to be overthrown, it's never going to be replaced. People were saying this about 20, 30 years ago, about how IBM was going to end up owning the planet. Where is IBM now? All kinds of really powerful companies suddenly find themselves subject to rival upstarts with new business models. But the other question is that of whether or not there's something inherent in the market that actually produces a monopoly, which means that although the monopoly may change, there's only ever one at one time, or maybe two or three at one time. As I say, in this case, I don't think this is a structural feature of this market. It's to do with a particular chance event, actually, the fact that the people who set up these platforms in the first place chose to fund them by providing a service free to users, but selling on the data that those users gave them. And I think that that was the mistake, if you will, right at the start. It made sense at the time, but I think that's what's had the bad results.
And surely it's going to have to change, isn't it? Because we're I think since 2016, a lot of these, like Facebook, Twitter, etc., have perhaps been blamed, actually. They've had whether that be Brexit or whether that be Donald Trump, the blame seems to be put squarely at their door. And the idea behind that is that they argue that it's big data that has led to Donald Trump.
Well, that is nonsense, quite honestly.
Yes.
I mean, that's a classic case of blaming the messenger. It really is the case that this is the conduit that has allowed people to suddenly realise there are lots more people out there who share their views. Now, if you disagree with those views, then this is rather an unpleasant surprise to discover that there are so many people who have views that you don't like. But the answer to that is not to try and shut down the means those people have of communicating with each other or with the wider world. It's to make your own case more effectively and try to win the democratic debate and argument. So I think actually this is a very lazy way of avoiding facing up to reality. If you've lost an election, as the Democrats have in the United States, for example, what you should not do is then whine and complain about how the media have been against you. You should try and work out why you lost the election, what was wrong with your case and its presentation, and how to do it better. And so, you know, like I say, shooting the messenger is never a wise option. That's what this is.
And indeed, I think a very short-term view on wanting to clamp down on free speech whilst they are the opponents, but realising actually it can very much be turned around on you as well, and the same arguments be used if you win an election.
Absolutely. I mean, to take the American case, for example, all the people who are saying that Facebook and other channels and platforms should be controlled because they've been misused allegedly by the Russians and imposing all kinds of controls that the Justice Department would exercise or other departments should ask themselves, well, how would you feel if someone Donald Trump has given this kind of power? You know, this is the classic case. You should always, whenever you think of giving government new powers, think, how would I feel if this power was in the hands of somebody I really, really don't like and distrust? And that usually should lead you to think, well, maybe that's not the right way to go.
And I think that's the perfect place to end that. Thank you very much, Steve. So what do you think at home? You can tweet us at IEA London with your thoughts. Is it a sensible step to keep users safe online or a dangerous attack on free expression? For more blogs, films, podcasts and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.